And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Hugh Van Kylenberg, who is the author of a new book called The Resilience Project, Finding Happiness Through Gratitude, Empathy and Mindfulness. Hugh has been working in education for more than 17 years, teaching both primary and secondary in a range of educational settings. He has completed postgraduate studies looking at resilience and well-being and has developed and facilitated programs for more than 1,000 schools Australia-wide and now internationally. In 2015, the National Rugby League asked Hugh to design and implement a series of comprehensive workshops at every single club in the competition. Since then, he has worked with the Australian cricket team, Australian netball team, Australian women's soccer team, Australian Olympic Committee, and every soccer team in the A-League. And beyond the team environment, he has worked one-on-one with well-known individuals like Steve Smith, Billy Slater, and Dustin Martin. Outside of schools and elite sport, Hugh has presented to hundreds of corporate organisations as a keynote speaker, and for 3 years has been running his national speaking tour, which has regularly sold out. Hugh, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure. Pleasure to be on the show.
So, Hugh, your book is called The Resilience Project. You've bounced back yourself from not having enough money to even buy a cup of coffee. Do you think that helps you relate to your audiences?
I hope so. I really hope I'm a relatable person throughout the book. Yeah, I was so keen to spread this message around the things we can do to make us feel happy that I quit my teaching job and tried to start a business, having no idea how to do that. And it was two or three very tough years, as anyone would know, tried to start their own business. Nowhere near as hard as being a father, I might add, but very, very tough. And there's a point where I was completely broke, but we kind of stuck at it and kept chipping away, and now we're in a position where we are fortunate enough to be helping hundreds of thousands of kids around the country, or people around the country, dads included.
Great, and you have that. You have a young son. Do you try and introduce those principles of gratitude, empathy, and mindfulness? Do you try to introduce them to him at this stage?
Yeah, so he's nearly three, and I have just. People ask me all the time, when do we start with our kids? And before I had kids, I was saying, oh, it's never too young stuff. But I could have learned now that at 2.5, I started to practice gratitude with him. So when I was put into bed, I would talk to him about the things that went well with our day. That's how you practice gratitude. You record the things that went well. So I'd put him to bed and I'd say, today, Grandma come over, and that was nice. Then we got to have an icy pole and we just reflected on all the fun things, all the things that went well for us. And then I've actually introduced meditation to him recently. Not your cross legs, hands in the air, making weird noises, but we'll have a bounce on the trampoline, and then we'll lie there together and I'll say, what can you hear? And he'll say, I can hear the birds, and I can hear Mummy, and I can hear cars. And that's him practicing being present, I suppose, and we do that a lot together. And if ever I notice he's a little bit on edge or a little bit sort of, a little bit anxious, we'll just lie down and think about the things we can hear, because that's practicing mindfulness. And the third one, empathy, which is when you think about how other people feel, I'm just trying really hard to model that to him now. And it's never too young to start with that. I'm just looking for opportunities to be there for other people, and I hope that he sees that and it influences the person that he wants to be.
You've worked in schools, both primary and secondary, in Australia. What do you see as the biggest problems in schools at the moment?
Oh, I don't know where to start. There's a few issues. I mean, if I'm trying to relate this to dads, two of the things that stand out to me is that we're not giving our kids the attention that they need for their emotional development. And the reason we're not is because we're more likely to just grab our phone and have a quick flick through our phone when we get a bit bored, as opposed with engaging with them. And I say it all the time, and I'm not saying I never do it. I'm not perfect, but going to the park with Benji, my son, I see parents all the time on their phones. You know, we put all this effort into working hard so we can take the family on incredible holidays and buy them these things, but they never ask for that. What they want more than anything is they want us. They want our attention. They want our affection. They want our love, and they're not getting it because if we're not working, we're at home or on our phones flicking through social media or emails or whatever it is. We have to, and I see the result with kids all the time at schools. And the other thing that we're doing, which which our kids need more of, is they need to learn to fight their own battles, and they need to learn that it's okay to stuff up and fail. These days, this generation of parents, of which I'm one, we're way too keen to just wrap our kids in bubble wrap and make sure nothing goes wrong for them, and we're fighting their battles for them. When we were growing up as kids, if we got in trouble at school, we'd go home and we'd have to deal with our parents, who would back up the teacher 100% of the time without fail. And it's the other way around now. Parents are siding with their kids and trying to get an explanation from the teacher. It doesn't work like that. We've got to back our teachers in. And so, that's a long answer to your question. Is we've got to give them more of our time and our attention. And we're not doing that because of our devices. And we need to stop wrapping with bubble wrap and make sure nothing goes wrong for them.
I think you've said that the question you're asked most often at these seminars with parents is about social media and using their mobile phones. What are your strategies? Because it's a little bit in the news at the moment, I think particularly in Victoria.
Yep. So, I have it in the book because I think it's a really important part, is that we all acknowledge we're on our phones too much. But the thing is, how do we actually get on? It's hard because so many of us are addicted. The four strategies I list in the book are very simple. Number one is to rearrange your home screen. You should only have apps on your home screen that are not addictive. There are so many addictive apps out there, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Don't have them on your home screen. Have them five or six screens across. Out of sight, out of mind, and only have apps on your home screen. I've only got three at the moment. I've got music, I've got podcasts, and I've got my calendar. That's it. None of those three are addictive. And when I look at them, I'm not tempted to go and look at them. So that leads me to my second tip, which is turn your notifications off. Right now, we don't decide when we check our phone. Our phone decides for us. Our phone will beep, it'll vibrate, we grab it straight away. We've got to get better at control. So you turn your notifications off and you decide when you check your phone. The third bit of advice is a pretty simple one. It's to leave your phone at home if you don't need it. So if you are going to the park with your kids, if you're going out for dinner with your whole family, you don't really, well, it's up to people, but it's up to everyone else to decide. But for me, out for dinner with Penny and Benji, my wife and my son, I don't need to take my phone there, so I don't take it. If I'm going out for a beer with a mate, I don't take my phone. If I'm going to the park with Benji, I don't take my phone. The thing we do right now, and you'll notice in Australia, is that whenever you're bored, the first thing you do is you grab your phone. And unfortunately, we can't. We'll be out at the park with our kids, we feel bored, we grab our phone straight away. Or out for dinner with the family, we just grab our phone as soon as we feel a little bit bored. We've got to get better at being creative in that moment and creating something interesting to do with the people around us, as opposed to disconnecting from them so we can connect with our phone. And the fourth bit of advice, which can cause people to be a little bit anxious, is to delete Facebook from your phone. They are the masters at sucking people into your phone. Just check it on your laptop or your computer, because they put so much money into addiction. Don't let them get you. And you'll be amazed how quickly that makes a difference in your life.
Yeah, I find it amazing when you're on a train these days and everybody is caught up in their own world looking at the phones. They talk as though they're in Maxwell Smart's booth, because they'll talk about all sorts of personal things, not caring who else is listening or whatever. It's amazing.
That's embarrassing.
It is. But you say in your book that generosity, empathy and mindfulness, they're not silver bullets, but do you think we should give mental health priority even at these young ages we've been talking about?
As a school teacher, I kept asking, as a young, inexperienced school teacher, I was like, what are we doing? What are we doing to help kids with mental health? And the reason I was interested was because my sister was diagnosed with a mental illness from a young age. But I said, oh, how are we teaching these young kids mental health stuff? And the answer was, well, we're not. We're doing maths, we're doing literacy, we're doing numeracy, we're doing science. And I was thinking, surely, if you get your mental health right and you're feeling good about yourself, surely you're a better chance of succeeding in these other areas. And everyone agreed, but there wasn't much happening. So that's sort of why I stopped teaching and created this program, which we've now got 110,000 kids around the country doing, which is really nice. But there's a lot of kids who aren't doing it. I'm not saying people have to do our program, but schools need to be investing in the mental health of their kids. It's the rates of mental illness in schools right now, we've got 40% of secondary school kids and 24% of primary school kids who are struggling with mental ill health. We need to be doing more for them.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary situation. And then you've worked with the national sporting teams, as I mentioned, the National Rugby League, the AFL, the Gillaroos. What about for older people? Would you say it's never too late to work on in this area?
Never, never, ever too late, because the research says it doesn't take that long for this stuff to start working. So, for example, you start practicing gratitude, 21 days later you report feeling happier, less anxiety, less depression, more optimistic about your life. So it doesn't matter how old you are, you practice this stuff, it can have an impact, and it can have an impact really quickly.
So I suppose the big question is, what does make us happy, in your view?
I think there's a couple of ways I'd answer that. So the neuroscience says that the way that to feel happier is to do things for other people, because your brain releases this hormone oxytocin. So that's a simple way of answering that question. The neuroscience says that being kind to other people is what makes us feel happy. That's backed up by a whole lot of different research. There are other things, though. One of the things that makes us happy is practicing gratitude. So when we actually pay attention to what we've got, we don't worry about what we don't have, which is something that a lot of us have troubles with. We think, oh, if I buy this car, I feel happy. If I live in this, we buy a house like this, then I feel happy. I get this promotion, then I feel happy. No, it doesn't work like that. You've got to pay attention to what you already have. We've got so much here in Australia. We miss the things we have all the time. And the other one, to bring in three key principles, is mindfulness. And that's when you're just living in the present moment. Apparently we spend 49% of our day thinking about the future. It's pretty hard to be happy when you're sitting there and you're having a lovely coffee with someone you love, but you're thinking about an interview you're going to come in a week or an email you're going to send later in the day. We're going to need to get better at enjoying what's happening as it's happening. And mindfulness is how you do that.
And we're speaking today with Hugh van Kylenberg, who is the author of a new book called The Resilience Project, Finding Happiness Through Gratitude, Empathy and Mindfulness. We might take a break now. Hugh, we always ask our guests to pick a song. Would you like to tell us which one you've picked and why you've picked it?
Yeah, so as a kid growing up, my mum and dad were very big Paul Simon fans, and we would listen to Paul Simon relentlessly. And I loved it as a kid, but then I sort of got over a little bit when I was trying to find my own musical taste. But when I reached my 20s, and I just found myself going back to Paul Simon, and particularly the album Graceland has been with me my entire life. I think back to any time I've gone through something quite hard in my life, sort of subconsciously, I just go back to Graceland and listen to it a lot. It just brings back many happy memories. So when Benji was born and we were tired and struggling a bit, I would play the Graceland album a bit at home, and now he's 3 years old. The only song he ever asked for is Call Me Out, but he doesn't call it You Can Call Me Out. He calls it Dirt, 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 Dirt. So he'll say, Dad, can we please play Dirt, 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 which is kind of the rhythm of how the song starts. So we'll be in the car and he'll say, Dada. And I say, yes, Benji. He says, Dirt, 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 Dirt. And we play it and he dances. Like, he just loves dancing to that song. It's his favourite song and it's become my favourite song again. So
down the street, he says, why am I soft in the middle now? Why am I soft in the middle? The rest of my life is so hard. I need a photo opportunity. I want a shot of redemption. Don't want to end up a cartoon in a cartoon graveyard. Bone digger, bone digger, dogs in the moonlight. Far away, my well-lit door. Mr. Beer Belly, Beer Belly, get these mutts away from me, you know. I don't find this stuff amusing anymore. If you'll be my bodyguard, I can be your long lost pal. I can call you Betty, Betty, when you call me, you can call me out. A man walks down the street, he says, why am I short of attention? Got a short little span of attention, and oh, my nights are so long. Where's my wife and family? What if I die here? Who'll be my role model? Now that my role model is gone, gone, he ducked back down the alley with some roly-poly little bat-faced girl. All along, along, there were incidents and accidents, there were hints and allegations. If you'll be my bodyguard, I can be your long-lost pal. I can call you Daddy. Mm-hmm. doesn't speak the language. He holds no currency. He is a foreign man. He is surrounded by the sound, Cattle in the marketplace, scatterings and orphanages. He looks around, He sees angels in the architecture, spinning in infinity. He says, amen, hallelujah, if you would be my bodyguard.
And that was You Can Call Me Al by Paul Simon, especially chosen for us today by our guest Hugh Van Kylenberg, who is the author of the new book called The Resilience Project. Hugh, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the history of how you worked out this GEM principle, generosity, empathy, mindfulness.
Yeah, of course. So I had always been fascinated by what it is that makes us feel happy and what improves our mental health, because of my little sister's battles with her anorexia nervosa and mental illness. And it really wasn't. That was 16. When my sister was 14, I was 16. That's when she became sick. And I became fascinated with what is it that makes us happy, because I really just wanted to help my mum and dad to feel happy again and my brother. But I, to be honest, I came up very short. I had no idea what to do. And then about probably, when was it? It would have been about 12 years later. That's when I found myself volunteering in a little underprivileged school in the far north of India, that I met this community of people who had so very little to call their own. They lived in little mud huts and they didn't have running water and there was no electricity. And I just found myself fascinated by how happy these people were, yet they had so very little. So what was meant to be a 2-week trip turned into a three-month trip. And I lived there and I just paid attention to what those people did every day at a very simple level. They practiced gratitude every day. They practiced empathy every day. And they practiced mindfulness every day. I joined in, had a huge impact on me, and I thought, gosh, this stuff's amazing. Came back to Australia, and I sort of thought, well, it's ridiculous that no one I know is practicing this stuff, yet the research says, I went back to university to study it because I was so fascinated by it, and I looked at the research behind these three things, and it turns out there is actually 40 years of research screaming at us. If we want to feel happier, if we want to improve our mental health, if we want to help someone who's struggling with a mental illness, we've got to start practicing these three things. And that's essentially how the program came about.
And like at other stages of your life, you just mentioned the influence of your sister, and there was another huge influence, a young fellow called Stanzen, who got you looking at the world differently too, I think.
I mean, all these kids are so incredible. He was one that really stood out, as he really modelled this stuff every day, this boy who slept on a dirt floor and he had the most basic living conditions. But I was just very drawn to him in this class, in this school up in the far north of India when I was volunteering, because I just felt like every time I was around him, I kept thinking, I've never seen joy like this in my life. She's just so unbelievably happy. And it was meant to be my last night there, but I discovered this. I saw this kid was sleeping on the floor, and I just, about seeing that and him in his school uniform going to sleep, it really hit home. And I just thought, gee, there's something really special about this kid and these people and the influence he's had on my life.
And then, the one I particularly liked was that he would look at something, whatever it was that he had, broken down swing.
Yeah.
And he'd
so he, 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 yeah. So he, I love that. Gratitude was the first thing I noticed with these kids, how grateful they were for the little things they had. And this kid actually stopped his day to practice gratitude, but he didn't put aside an hour to practice gratitude. He just waited. When he saw something he was grateful for, he stopped, big smile on his face, he'd point to whatever it was, and he'd try and say the word this, but he couldn't pronounce the TH. He would say this instead. English was his third language, so he found it quite hard. He was doing very well, but he would say, "Sir, look, this. And he'd point to things like his shoes. You know, he was saying, "Look, I've got shoes on my feet." Or it might be that he was pointing out something like his lunch. You know, we would cook rice for the kids every day because they couldn't afford to bring lunch to school. He'd point to his rice and he'd say, "Sir, this. He was saying, "Was how lucky am I? I have food here to eat every lunchtime." So the dish story has had a big impact on quite a few people, as it turns out.
I think some AFL footballers have even written it on their wrists, haven't they, just to remind them at the stage of the game how lucky they are.
Adam Treloar, a Collingwood star midfielder, on his wrist every single game, he writes a disc to remind himself, no matter how anxious he might be feeling during a game, no matter how stressed he might be feeling, he is so lucky to be doing the stuff he's doing and have the things that he's got in his life.
Yeah, I think there should be a bit more of that. But what would you say were the biggest differences you found from working in schools at the base of the Himalayas and, say, working in Melbourne or somewhere in Victoria?
Oh, great question. The most obvious thing that stood out to me was that kids here in Australia or Melbourne, Victoria, they don't cope well when things don't go their way. So if they don't get what they want, or there's a little issue at school, or they fall over, or they... I'm not saying they're putting it on, but it's almost like a performance of tears of this drama and the theatre around not getting what they want, or even just hurting themselves. So these kids in the far north of India, if things didn't go their way, there was not even a look of disappointment or register on their face. It was just, they just got on with things straight away. First time I noticed it was, from working in schools in Australia, you see kids, they fall over and they'll graze their knees really badly, and there's that pause for a couple of seconds when they register the damage on their knee, and then it's this hyperventilating type crying. And that's fine. I'm not saying kids shouldn't cry when they hurt themselves. I think crying is a very healthy thing to do. But I remember seeing a kid do this in India. He tripped and fell running at full pace and took layers of skin off. And he just kind of smiled and got up and walked off. And there was no... I was waiting for the tears, but it was nothing. It was just... I think they tend to deal with life's curveballs a little bit better, is the first thing I'd say.
Back in Australia, there have been some other influential characters. You describe the scorer Luke and Beefy, who is sort of has become an inspirational speaker. But I guess the starting point is to let them know how much you care. That these kids are probably ignored in large parts of the community, but you actually were able to draw them out and get them contributing.
Yeah, so Bill, I played cricket for a club called Melbourne University in the Victorian Premier League, and I played there for 20-odd years or something. But we had a program where we would invite people from Autism Australia, people on the spectrum, to come down and score for us and score for our career club because we needed scorers. And we had a guy called Luke come down and volunteer his time, and this man was a 43-year-old man who struggled with autism, and he really struggled. I mean, the social situations were just so anxiety-provoking for him, as they often are for people on the spectrum. But we did everything we could to involve this young man in the club, and we told him how much we loved him all the time and how valued he was. And I mean, one day, and this is a big part of the book, is that we have to reach out and ask people how they're going all the time, and if we're not sure about someone, we've got to ask. And I had the opportunity to ask Luke. He called me one day to ask how long the cricket season started. And I said, "Mate, it's a couple of weeks away. We're nearly there. I'll see you in a couple of weeks." And he said to me, "That feels like a long time to me at the moment." And I thought, "Gosh, is he all right?" But I thought, "Oh, it's probably his autism. I'm sure he's fine." And I hung up the phone and told my wife Penny, and she said, "You should call him back and check." And I said, "Look, he'll be back. He'll be at the club in a couple of weeks. I'll ask him, then he'll be fine." And I tragically get a phone call couple of days later from the president of my club saying, "Look, Luke took his life." And I hadn't, my job is mental health. I help people with stuff all the day, but even I didn't think to ask if it was okay. And as a reminder that we never know what's going in someone else's backyard, and if we're not sure, we've got to ask the question. I think about Luke all the time, but I regret that I didn't ask if it was okay. But if anything can come from it. It's every time I do a presentation in the book, I'm just trying to remind people, hey, if you're not sure about someone, have the courage to just check in and say how you're travelling.
And, well, a happier story, I guess, is Beefy, who he's now right at home among elite sports people.
He is. Beefy, now, I never know how to tell Beefy's story. He's a water boy at my career club. I taught him when he was 18 years old in my school. And cerebral palsy. He has also too much fluid on his brain. He had a stroke when he was born and has quite a few disabilities. But you wouldn't know it from the way he lives his life. He's into everything, especially the Collingwood Footy Club. And I invited him down to our career club to be a water boy. And he became a cult figure very quickly. And after a few years at the club, he asked if he could give a motivational speech to the players. And I said, are you sure? So I said, okay, you go for it, mate. And he gave this incredible motivational speech. And I remember telling the Collingwood Football Club that Nathan Buckley said, well, let's get him down to the club. Let's get him to be a water boy for us. Because Nathan turned out he was a Collingwood supporter. He said, well, let's invite him down. He said, why don't we get him down to the club and be a water boy for us, and he can give a motivational talk for us. And it was a small thing Nathan Buckley did, but you look back on the message of empathy and doing things for other people. It was a small thing. But I'm telling you now, it has made Beefy's life. It happened 3 years ago. He still doesn't stop smiling from it. We do things for other people. It is good for us and it's good for them.
Would you be able to sum it up in a couple of words what you see as the main purpose of the Resilience Project?
It's to help people to understand there are things they can do to feel happy at a very basic level. There are things we can always feel happier. We can always improve our mental health. It's great to go and see a psychologist. We highly recommend that. But there are things you can do in the privacy of your own room that will help you to feel happier. And that's what the Resilience Project's about. It's presenting that stuff in a non-philosophical or deep and meaningful way. It's just some practical stuff that you can do every day that'll make you feel happier.
Something like your presentations all around Australia. But I want to make a special thank you to Hugh Van Kylenberg. Hugh, thank you very much for being a guest on Dad's on the Air.
Pleasure, Bill. Thank you so much, mate.
So don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.